This is the second part of our coverage of the little Napoleon of showmanship, Billy Rose. That's not only his name, it's also the story of his life in two words. For rise he certainly did, from poverty and obscurity to fame and fortune. A Wall Street tycoon, he owned more shares of American Telegraph and Telephone than any other person. He presented some of the most lavish shows imaginable, and his name appeared on some of the most popular songs in Tin Pan Alley history. Last week, we began with a few of these songs, and here are some more.
Clap hands, here comes Charlie. Clap hands, good time, Charlie. Clap hands, here comes Charlie now.
Yoo-hoo, Charlie.
This way, join the party. I say, meet McCarty. Hey, hey, Charlie, take a bow.
Ginger ale, white rock, this table. Hey, join the party. Here, move over there. Let him sit right next to Mabel.
Clap hands, here comes Charlie.
In Monterey a long time ago, I met her in Monterey in old Mexico. Stars and steel guitars and luscious lips as red as wine broke somebody's heart, and I'm afraid that it was mine. It happened in Monterey without thinking twice. I left her and threw away the key to paradise. My indiscreet heart longs for the sweetheart that I left in old Monterey.
As we finished last week, Billy Rose had just made his bow as a Broadway producer with a revue starring his wife, Fanny Brice. It was none too successful, but Rose was nothing if not determined. A year later, he presented a play by Ben Hecht and Gene Fowler, which was one of the most resounding flops of 1932. It was called The Great Magoo, and it's only remembered today because a melody, which was used as a recurring theme through the play, later became famous with these words.
Say it's only a paper moon, sailing over a cardboard sea. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Yes, it's only a canvas sky, hanging over a cotton tree. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Without your love, it's a honky-tonk parade. Without your love, it's a melody played in a penny arcade. It's a Barnum and Bailey world, just as hollow as it can be. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed.
It's Only a Paper Moon, music by Harold Arlen, words by E.Y. Harburg, and Billy Rose, or so it says here. Now, last week we aired the news of a great many people on the question, was Billy Rose really a lyric writer, or was he just a publicity-seeking phony who took credit for work he didn't do? Well, the opinions were pretty evenly divided. But since last week, we've unearthed a true story concerning the comedian Fred Allen, who brought down the house at a charity show attended almost exclusively by people from show business. The year was 1926, and Fred Allen's joke was this. You know, ladies and gentlemen, as a writer, I think Billy Rose can be compared to Shakespeare, and nobody knows who wrote his stuff either. Well, Rose didn't care what people said about him as long as he was the topic of conversation, and as long as they didn't refer to him as Fanny Bryce's husband. Playing second fiddle to his talented wife played merry hell with his ego. When he opened Billy Rose's music hall in 1934, he thought of an ideal way to eclipse his wife. Outside his new club, he had an electric sign erected. It was 14 stories high and consisted of two words, Billy Rose. He stood there the first night admiring it when two men walked by. The first one said, "Who's Billy Rose?" The second one said, "Oh, come on, everybody knows that's Fanny Bryce's husband." Well, this song, which may or may not have had a lyric by Rose, was featured in the first show at his music hall.
Now I'm not showing you the door, I'm just laying down the law. You gotta see Mama every night, or you can't see Mama at all. You gotta kiss Mama, treat her right, or she won't be home when you call. Now I don't care for that kind of a man who loves his Mama on the installment plan. You've got to see Mama every night, or you can't see Mama at all. For instance, Monday night, I sat alone. Tuesday night, you didn't phone. Wednesday night, you didn't call. Thursday night, the same old song. Friday night, you dodged my path. Saturday night, you took your bath. Sunday night, you called on me, but you broke your wife and your family. Now you gotta see Mama every night, or you can't see Mama at all. You gotta kiss Mama, treat her right, or she won't be home when you call. Now I don't care for that kind of a chic who does the chicing once a week. You gotta see Mama every night, or you can't see Mama at all.
In 1935, Rose gave the world Jumbo, a show that's still talked about in awed tones to this very day. Musical historian Stanley Green tells how this super show got started and describes Billy Rose's physical appearance.
It was about 5 feet tall, 5 feet one, I don't know. Certainly a very unprepossessing looking man. And perhaps because of that, he had the desire to put on the biggest and most elaborate productions he could. He was called the Bantam Barnum by his press agent, who built up that image of the man who was short in stature but very long in ideas, creating mammoth productions on Broadway. And Jumbo was the culmination of his idea of combining musical comedy with spectacle, with circus. So we actually had the Hippodrome Theater gutted and redesigned as something of an amphitheater, so that he had the seats banked up as if you would be at a circus. And there was one ring, and the story that they were concerned with, which wasn't a very brilliant story, but it was a takeoff on the Romeo and Juliet kind of thing, and of all people, it was written by Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur.
Hecht and MacArthur were expensive, and so was everyone else Rose wanted for his epic. To raise the vast sums needed to finance his dream, he went on a backer hunt. Johnny Mercer knew something about this.
There's a story that he went to see Alfred P. Sloan, who was the president of General Motors, and he said, "Tell him Mr. Rose is calling." And the secretary said, "What's it about, Mr. Rose? Tell him I want to see him about some elephants," he said. And that got him out of the office. He came out of the office because he was curious who was going to come up to see him about elephants.
But the amount of money needed to get Jumbo on was too vast for any backer. That is, until Rose found the multimillionaire Jock Whitney, who, with the help of his sister, came up with $225,000. Typical of Rose was the way he began pointlessly annoying Whitney as the long rehearsals progressed. Every time they met, Rose would greet Whitney with the infuriating, "Hi, sucker!" But the backer extracted his revenge. Knowing that Rose was sensitive about his height, or lack of it, Whitney hired a man who was exactly as tall as Rose and sent him along to the theater where the showman was interviewing circus performers. When Rose asked this man what he did, the man replied, "I'm a midget." Rose almost had apoplexy. To write the score for Jumbo, Rose secured the services of two men who had once written the songs for an unsuccessful nightclub he'd run 8 years earlier. Their names were Rogers and Hart.
The most beautiful girl in the world picks my ties out, eats my candy, drinks my brandy. The most beautiful girl in the world. The most beautiful star in the world isn't Garbo, isn't Dietrich, but the sweet trick. Who can make me believe it's a beautiful world? Social, not a bit. Natural kind of wit. She'd shine anywhere, and she hasn't got platinum hair. The most beautiful house in the world has a mortgage. What do I care? It's goodbye care when my slippers are next to the ones that belong to the one and only beautiful girl in the world.
The star of Jumbo was Jimmy Durante, massively supported by Paul Whiteman and his orchestra, Stanley's Bears, Camilla's Birds, 30 clowns, 50 aerialists, a giant elephant called Big Rosie, and an army of contortionists, jugglers, axe throwers, and bareback riders. And, of course, there were also singers to render those marvelous songs.
My romance doesn't have to have a moon in the sky. My romance doesn't need a blue lagoon standing by. No month of May, no twinkling stars, no hide away, no soft guitars. My romance doesn't need a castle rising in Spain, nor a dance to a constantly surprising refrain. Wide awake, I can make my most fantastic dreams come true. My romance doesn't need a thing but you.
Jumbo marked the musical comedy debut of that supremely talented man of the theater, George Abbott, who found working with Billy Rose quite an experience.
He rehearsed the actors about 12 weeks, and broke some of their arms, and so, you know, we were shooting out of guns and things we were doing. I was the director of it. I worked on it for 5 or 6 weeks. Then I got sick of it, and I went away and came back to finish it up after they got through with some of the circus things. Tricky.
It was indeed, and so was Billy Rose, as the Jumbo rehearsals showed. His schemer's mind worked out that Jumbo, technically, was not a show but a circus, which meant that it didn't come under the terms of an actor's equity contract. Hence, a really unscrupulous producer wouldn't have to pay his circus performers for rehearsals. Rose didn't, and Jumbo rehearsed for 6 long months.
Swing high, swing low, upon the trapeze. At first you'll fall, but then a year from now you'll do it with ease. Over and over and over again. A star does not come out of the sky. He starts to work at 10. To reach the top, you gotta keep trying. Over and over and over and over and over and over.
According to Stanley Green, Jumbo was a nightmare to rehearse.
It was a devil of a thing to put together because he had animals rehearsing in one place, he had the story rehearsing in someplace else, he had the dances someplace else, he had the circus acts someplace else. It was all over town, and it was delayed and delayed and delayed, and he had a big sign up in front of the hippodrome saying, "Shh, Jumbo is rehearsing." Well, he delayed the opening so often that the day that it opened, he had an ad in the newspaper. It was an affidavit swearing that Jumbo was going to open that very evening. Well, it did open, of course, and it was very well received by the critics. Got rave notices.
So Jumbo's opening was after no fewer than 5 postponements. There was no overture. The show began with a deafening fanfare, after which Paul Whiteman made his entrance on a huge white horse. His band marched along behind, dressed in brilliant circus uniforms of blue and gold, playing Rogers Stirring, "The Circus is on Parade." Following them came the most dazzling circus parade ever. Next, a girl was shot out of a cannon and caught by a man who suddenly leapt out of the audience and into the ring just in time. At this point, the audience heard a terrifying scream overhead. They looked up to the top balcony and saw a daring young lady named Tiny Klein slide 300 feet to the stage, holding onto a taut wire with her teeth. Before the customers could recover from this, 3 aerialists who worked without a safety net zoomed around the theater at a fantastic speed, hanging by their insteps from the wings of a tiny aeroplane. Then a man on a wire performed tumbling tricks over an open cage full of tigers and lions, finishing his act by dramatically snapping his wire and swinging by his hands into the cage, then swinging out again just as the beasts made a dash for him. And that was just the first scene.
Hold your horse, here they come, rat-a-tat, go the drum.
Although the critics loved Jumbo as much as everyone else, it wasn't a financial success. Well, how could it be when it rehearsed for 6 months and then ran for only 5? Rose used to say that the show was too big for its cash register. What one Broadway wag said was, "You just can't mix silk and elephant droppings." As a result of all the Jumbo publicity, Rose was invited to stage the Frontier Days celebration at Fort Worth, Texas. The major success of the exposition was the Casa Mañana, the largest nightclub-come-theater in the world. For one of the spectacular shows he put on there, a song was specially written, one of the most beautiful ballads with which Rose's name is connected.
The night is young and you are so beautiful here among the shadows, beautiful lady. Oh, open your heart. The scene is set, the breeze, the sing of it. Can't you get into the swing of it, lady? When do we start? When a lady is kissable and the evening is cool, any dream is permissible in the heart of a fool. The moon is high and you're so glamorous, and if I seem over amorous, lady, what can I do? The night is young and I'm in love with you.
The shows at the Casa Manana were directed by the versatile John Murray Anderson, one of the few people who refused to be bullied by Rose. Once, during an argument at rehearsal, the little showman shouted at him, "I have a fistful of money. What have you got?" Anderson shouted back, "I have one friend." In 1938, Rose opened a nightclub in the basement of New York's Paramount Hotel. It was an immediate success.
I am the chef.
Ladies and gentlemen, he is the chef.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am Pierre.
Ladies and gentlemen, he is Pierre.
I am Pierre and I am the chef, and I know my food with a capital F.
Ladies and gentlemen, he is the chef, and he knows his food with a capital F. Even the chef.
The composer, Johnny Green, remembers the Diamond Horseshoe well. His wife used to work there.
That was the biggest nightclub that ever was, you know. The food was good there, and the drinks weren't cut. It was a classy nightclub, and expensive. Not as expensive as some of the little boîte, because Billy, again, not only did he have the broad brush and the big concept in terms of what was on the stage, but he also had an eye to that in the box office, you see. So Billy always did things that had a big commercial appeal.
The appeal at the Horseshoe was to the customer's nostalgia. The club's first show featured two veteran performers singing songs they'd first introduced many years before. Fritzy Chef sang Kiss Me Again, and Joe Howard gave out with I Wonder Who's Kissing Her Now.
I wonder who's kissing her now. I wonder who's showing her how. Wonder who's looking into her eyes, breathing sighs, telling lies.
I wonder who's buying the wine for lips that I used to call my own. I wonder if she ever tells him of me.
I wonder kissing her now.
Billy Rose used Joe Howard in a number of shows at the Diamond Horseshoe and was fond of him, doubtless because a court case had proved that I Wonder Who's Kissing Her Now, which Howard claimed to have written, was actually written by someone else. In the 1930s, Billy Rose coined a new word, aquacade. This was a kind of spectacular musical water circus, and Rose presented many of them all over the country. The star was usually swimmer Eleanor Holm, who became the showman's second wife. When Rose divorced Fanny Bryce for her, one columnist wrote, "Lots of marriages have been broken up by liquor. All it took to break up Billy and Fanny was water." The Aquacade at the 1939 World's Fair earned Rose a net profit of $1 million. This song was written for that show.
Yours for a song of romance. Yours for a song, if romance has a chance. Yours for the spell of a melody. One that will stay when you're away from me. I'm yours in the glow of that low-hanging moon, trading my heart for a tune. That moon is out of sight. I'm yours for a song tonight.
Having made a fortune from the Aquacade and the Horseshoe, Rose was eager to put his profits into something that would bring him prestige, a really distinguished success on Broadway, for instance. The chance came in 1943, resulting in his biggest hit ever. Some years before, Oscar Hammerstein, depressed and out of work after a dispiriting run of unsuccessful musicals, started to fill in the time by writing, strictly on spec, an American version of Bizet's Carmen, set in a southern town during World War II. He wrote it for an all-black cast, and instead of working in a cigarette factory, Carmen now made parachutes. Don Jose became Joe, an army corporal. The toreador, Escamillo, was now a boxer named Husky Miller. And the innkeeper, Lilas Pastia, turned into Billy Pasta, a man in a similar line of work.
There's a cafe on the corner, run by my friend Billy Pasta. A spot where a man takes a lady when he wants to move faster. Guess I'll go and say hello to Pasta. How can a lady drink alone? How can a lady dance alone? No lady can romance alone. I ought to have a sweetie pie. Do what I had, I give the air to. I threw his toothbrush out the door. Now that I'm free, my heart is sighing. I'm off to Hark and looking for more. Dozens of fellas telephone me, all asking me to make a date. I'm holding out for something special, but I don't know how long I'll wait. Where will I wind up? Who'll I be true to? Ain't made my mind up, waiting for you to. What you say, brother? What you say, boy? In a time that we gotta wait. 10 o'clock sharp on the corner. See that you're right in there pitching. 'Cause I ain't the kind of a man that'll stand without hitching. Now you got your little filly at the starting gate. Got a little filly who is willing to
go. Eventually, Oscar Hammerstein took his Black Carmen to the noted orchestrator Robert Russell Bennett.
He and I were sort of working on it together, and we, in a way, were peddling it together. And we had Max Gordon, who liked the show but hadn't raised the money, and Oscar decided he wasn't going to wait for Max Gordon to raise the money, and he went out to peddle it again, and he got hold of Billy Rose, and Billy was quite crazy about it, and came and listened to the Carmen music without Oscar's lyrics, and we talked to him about it. And Billy Rose said, "How serious are you fellas about my doing this show?" And Oscar said, "Well, we're very serious." He said, "How serious are you about doing it?" And Billy Rose said, "Oh, I like it." He said, "I'm crazy about it." So the beauty of it was that Billy could just reach in his pocket and pull out the amount of money that he needed. He didn't go out to get backers. He just had the money whenever we wanted. So he did. He just produced it.
Rose assembled the finest creative staff possible for Carmen Jones. He even tried to hire Sir Thomas Beecham to conduct, but when this proved impossible, he signed the very accomplished Joseph Littal. Carmen Jones tried out in Philadelphia, where it was a great success. After the performance, a rival producer came up to Rose and told him, "Swell show, but let's face it, you'll have to get yourself a new score. Everybody knows this music."
Stand up and fight until you hear the bell. Stand toe to toe, trade blow for blow. Keep punching till you make your punches tell. Show that crowd what you know. Until you hear that bell, that final bell, stand up and fight like hell.
When you fight out in the open air, in a patch of light, the ring looks small and white. Out in the blackness, you can feel 100,000 eyes filling the night. Cigarettes are blinking in the dark and making polka dots around the baseball park. People are quiet
and there's a riot. Someone throws a punch and plants it right smack on the mark.
Someone's hurt, you kinda think it's you. You hang across the ropes, that's all you wanna do. Then you look around and see your trainer's eyes begging you to see it through. They say, remember, big boy, remember.
The thing I found out about Billy Rose is, was summed up in what he said one time. We were talking about one of the little difficult things in Carmen Jones, and we had Hazard Short as a producer. I was sort of holding out for what was in the original opera for this particular spot, because it seemed to me it was very good. And Billy Rose said, when he said, "I found out one thing about this show," he says, "the artistic thing is the commercial thing." And this is a smart remark, you know. And it showed, it wasn't idly said at all. He knew what he was talking about.
Carmen Jones took the Broadway critics by storm, said the New York Daily News, "It is superb, it is enchantingly beautiful, it is musically exciting and visually stirring. Billy Rose, my hat is off to you, and I bow low." Rose wasn't noted for his truthfulness, but he used to swear that one of his cronies phoned him during the run of Carmen Jones saying, "Hey, Billy, you ought to sue. They're doing your show down at the Metropolitan Opera House in whiteface." The two-year triumph of Carmen Jones whetted Rose's appetite for yet more glory. Why not give wartime New York a real evening of pre-war escapism? Put on the kind of extravaganza they used to do. Nono Otero had this to say.
He actually wanted to be the Mr. Ziegfeld of his day. I mean, this was his ambition. Although he had the ambition, the eyes were big enough, and he seemed to have the backing financially. Taste-wise, it just wasn't the same thing. Ziegfeld was really the man when it came to that kind of thing.
But Billy Rose wasn't going to let a little thing like his lack of taste stand between him and immortality.
His next move was to buy a theater to house his forthcoming hit. He chose, surprise, surprise, the old Ziegfeld Theater. Bought, repaired, remodeled, and reopened it with what he felt sure was the greatest review ever. "This show only has one message," he told an agent, "and this is it. Compared to Billy Rose, Ziegfeld was a bum." Now, to drive his message home, he secured the pricey services of Beatrice Lilly, Bert Lahr, Alicia Markova, Anton Dolin, and Benny Goodman in his band. He commissioned Salvador Dali to paint 7 originals to adorn the foyer, Moss Hart, George S. Kaufman, and Ben Hecht to write the comedy, Igor Stravinsky to write a new ballet, and to write the songs Cole Porter.
Every time we say goodbye, I die a little.
Rose's review, which incidentally was called 7 Lively Arts, had a very fraught rehearsal period and an even fraughter out-of-town tryout. Nothing went right, including in Rose's view the ballet that Stravinsky had written for Markova and Dolin. Rose sent a telegram to Stravinsky saying, "Your music, great success, stop. Could be sensational if you would authorize Robert Russell Bennett retouch orchestration, stop. Bennett orchestrates even Cole Porter, stop." Stravinsky wired back 3 words, "Satisfied with success, stop." The 2 comedy stars of 7 Lively Arts were feeling distinctly unfunny. Bert Lahr kept asking Rose for new material and never getting any. B. Lilly, who called the show 7 Deadly Arts, was anything but happy with the songs Cole Porter had written for her.
When I was a little cuckoo, was I full of mischief, oh boy. Flitting hither and thither, far from thither and thither, I lived in a dither of joy. Each dawn another fond goodbye. And if my wings became singed and my tail if it brings, well, just a little cuckoo was I.
December 1944, just before his show opened, Rose described 7 Lively Arts to a journalist It's the last word in complete escapism. A super Christmas tree, a grab bag of fun, anything you want to call it. They called it everything from disappointing to dreary. But despite bad notices, the review ran for 7 lively months. It wasn't a money maker, but it wasn't a money loser either. That same year, a Hollywood agent rang Rose and announced that 20th Century Fox wanted to make a film set in the Diamond Horseshoe to co-star Betty Grable and Dick Hames. Rose asked, "What do I have to do?" The agent answered, "Sign your name on the back of the check." Rose signed all right.
The more I see you, the more I want you. Somehow this feeling just grows and grows. With every sigh, I become more mad about you, more lost without you. And so it goes. Can you imagine how much I love you? The more I see you, as years go by, I know the only one for me can only be. My arms won't free you. My heart won't cry.
The film was completed in 1944, but just before its release, Rose found out that his name wasn't part of the title. After he'd held up the film's release for a year, the studio finally gave in and called it Billy Rose's Diamond Horseshoe. Now, it would take most people 60 years to do what Rose did in the next 20. He divorced Eleanor Holm, married an actress, divorced the actress, remarried the actress, re-divorced the actress, then married a millionaire in March and divorced her in June. He signed a contract to write a newspaper column, which appeared for years, but which he didn't write. He produced a straight play, a failure, and bought a broken-down theatre called The National, changing its name to, you've guessed it, The Billy Rose. Whatever he paid for that theatre, I'd say it was a bargain, because it led to his meeting Arthur Kanter, one of his few friends.
I met him in 1958 when I produced my first play, and I negotiated with him for the Billy Rose Theater. And it was a very tough negotiation, and as a matter of fact, we parted, not bitterly, but with not a terrible amount of affection for each other. I mean, I had less for him than he had for me. I mean, he was a very tough bargainer. And I just refused to do business with him. I said, "You're too tough." And he called me. He had reached a certain eminence in terms of his wealth and power, so that not many people, particularly of my age, I was much younger then, would dare to cross him. And he was very nice to me. He said, "I admire your spirit." He said, "Come on and have dinner with me, and I'll explain to you why I'm the way I am." And I went over and had dinner with him at his mansion on East 93rd Street. And he talked about his beginnings, but he was short of stature, which was always a factor, I think, in his success, you know, because it spurred him. If he'd been a foot taller, he'd have been less successful, but happier.
In 1964, 2 years before his death, he objected in print to the casting of Barbara Streisand as his ex-wife Fanny Brice in the musical Funny Girl. But he changed his mind when he saw the show on its first night. At a party afterwards, Barbara Streisand came up to him and said, "I understand I was married to you once. How was I?" Rose answered, "Great for the first 5 years."
When you're down and out, lift up your head and shout. There's gonna be a great day. Gabriel,
When Billy Rose died, his funeral service was held in the Ziegfeld Theatre, highly appropriate for the last public appearance of a man who said of himself, good, bad, big or little, I have done about 100 shows in my life, and I think I am understating that in the past 30 years, I sold substantially more than 100 million tickets to the public.
Well, there we leave the Billy Rose story and Michael Craig. Michael will be back with a further program in the American Showman series at the same time next week.